I have many things to tell ye this morning, which ye may not be able to bear. I've been listening both in here and outside of here to what you take to be the important questions with respect to the whole problem of the power of corporations and its social control. And I jotted down at the end of the session yesterday a number of things that seemed to be important to people in here, and I'm going to make some comments on each of them today. And I hope I can do this, and I will. I'll be able to do this in a relatively brief time so that we can talk. So that you can, first of all, ask questions to clarify what I've said, and then take issue with it and raise additional questions that I've neglected either completely or partially, or point out how I've begged the problem but that posed it, because these things all happen. I want to begin, well, let me tell you what I'm going to touch on, the meaning of monopoly and the prevalence of monopoly, the political power of corporations, the idea that we are powerless somehow or the other, the widespread belief that we're the pawns of some kind of powerful social forces about which we can do nothing. Shelley, where's Bill this morning? He's the guy who was very alarmed about that. He's in bed, powerless, right? Now, what is the power of which he is the pawn? Advertising, a few words on that, and some new developments in the control of advertising that I think are very dangerous. And how many lawyers are here? Maybe you guys can contribute some of this. I want to say a few words about the consumerism movement, the death of caveat emptor, and the rise of caveat vendor, and the implications of this. And then some words about government regulation, and then a little thing I tacked on because I mention that? It says not for release. It's not a secret document, is it? Something that I think is well worth mentioning, which occurred to me to mention, largely because I read a 22-page document that Raleigh handed me yesterday. Okay. So that's what I'm going to start with. First of all, monopoly, the meaning of monopoly. Now, I think this is a word that we ought to be very, very careful in using. Monopoly means literally sole seller. That's the literal meaning. There is only one seller. Now, if you think about it, everyone who sells anything is a monopolist. Holden Village is a monopolist because Holden Village is the sole seller of camping space of this type in this area with, Holden Village is unduplicatable. And you say, oh, we knew that, it's unique. But I hope you realize that Camp Pooksie Tawny on the shores of the Brisket River is also unique. There's no other place right there with those people. You say, oh, well, there are plenty of substitutes, and that's the key. How many substitutes are there? I am the sole seller of economics, principles of economics at SMU, as taught by me. And that's a unique product. And there may be we'll say, thank goodness. But the point is, there are good substitutes for that. There are lots of other people offering a product that is, who cares? But now, if you realize that substitutes, the concept of substitutes is the key, and you realize that also for Bell Telephone, there are substitutes. The Bell Telephone isn't a monopoly either. What are some of the substitutes for the services of Bell Telephone? Well, there are other telephone companies in the country. You can say, but Bell Telephone's the only one that provides a service in my area. Well, you could move to another area. Ridiculous. Well, what are some of the substitutes for telephone? Mail, shouting, running, driving. Shutting up? Radio. What? Radio? Yeah. Yeah. And you say, but they're not good substitutes. Okay, maybe they're not. For a lot of people, they obviously aren't. But that focuses our attention on the question, how good are the substitutes? It seems to me that we ought not to use the word monopoly in this way, because it obscures the fact that there are substitutes for everything. And what we're really concerned about is the degree of market power. In other words, you get alarmed about Bell Telephone because you think that there are that the substitutes for a telephone service provided by Bell are so poor that Bell kind of has you over the barrel. And you don't like to be over the barrel, but that's a matter of degree. Now, there's another meaning of the word monopoly that I think is important. Historically, the word monopoly meant somebody who received a special grant of privilege from the government, sometimes called a letter of patent. Our word patent is related to that. A patent is really a special right granted to an inventor by the government, a right to be the sole seller of this product for a limited number of years. And the patent privilege, and it is a privilege, was created by the Constitution in the belief that this would encourage the development of sciences and the useful arts. Whether it does or not is a much debated question. But governments in the United States are very much in the business of passing out these kinds of special privileges. Not just public utilities, or of course you should begin with the East India Company, in which our history is rooted, but the public utilities, you know, which have special franchises, the Postal Service, the American Medical Association, liquor sellers, morticians, airlines, crop dusters, barbers, plumbers. In fact, it is very difficult to find businesses in which there are not special grants of privileges that the government has passed out. How come? Because the people who get into the business usually organize and lobby to secure such special grants of privilege. Now, I call these monopoly grants when I'm using the word monopoly, but really I don't like to use the word monopoly. I try not to stick it into my vocabulary because it means so many different things to different people. I prefer to talk about special grants of privilege from the government. There's Bill. Good morning, Bill. Recently, last year, the Texas legislature passed a law creating a special automobile dealers control board that was supposed to, according to the billing that the public got, this board's job was to protect the customer against fraudulent practices in automobile repair, and then sort of in the little print, in other ways, regulate the industry. Well, it turned out, there was a provision that something like 80%, 4 out of 5 of the members of the board had to be franchised automobile dealers. And then it turns out that one of their very interesting powers is the power to decide whether a new dealer could move into an area or not. And the public doesn't find this out until about a year later when they discover a guy named W.O. Bankston, who has opened a huge Datsun dealership and whose chairman of the board has refused permission to two franchises, a Volkswagen franchise and a Toyota franchise. And his explanation was fascinating, that I am giving these men the benefit of our vast experience. We are protecting them against the consequences of their own foolishness. They would go bankrupt if... But listen, this stuff is rampant throughout the economy. The federal government, state governments, and municipal governments are in the business of granting these special privileges. And I'm stressing this because I think these special privileges are bad. I think they do a lot of damage. I think they make the economy less competitive, I think they're an important cause of inflation and inequity and all sorts of other things, but also because a lot of people think that the government ought to do something about monopoly. And I want you to notice that one of the most important things, the most important thing that the government could do about monopoly is stop creating so much of it. If the government would just jerk the special privileges out from under groups like lawyers, doctors, teachers, righto, it'd be a lot more equitable world. The government is a very prolific producer of monopoly. This question came up, huh? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, at least along the loop. Well, they managed to create monopolies in booze in almost every state. Don, who's from California?
I am.
I heard a voice, I didn't see up there. Oh yeah, there's. What's the current selling price for a liquor license in California, Don?
You can draw a liquor license for $6,000.
Mm-hmm. No, that's just how much it's worth to somebody to get a hold of a government approval. It used to be a lot higher. They must be passing out more of them.
Mm-hmm.
22,000 is, it's gone down a little then. Yeah.
The license is before a given date. I don't know what it is right now. You can sell for more than 6,000. The state government will allow you to gain blue sky or goodwill.
Yeah.
from your business. Right now, you're pretty well regulated as far as how you can sell your business. You get so much as far as stock is concerned, that there's a certain percentage of your gross profit that you can get for goodwill. But that's pretty well controlled.
Well, yeah, pretty well controlled. not in the interest of the consumer. Oh, the probably the most beautiful example, what's a television channel worth?
Whoa.
Oh boy, a couple million. You know, just, and they're just granted. They're sort of arbitrarily, the Boston Herald, yeah, recently lost its channel for reasons that maybe quite escaped me. Except one could say that they got it for no good reason in the first place, but they lost it for no good reason in the second place. But there, it's just the government reaches in and takes $2 million away from one group and gives it to another.
Yeah.
Or more, 2 million, heck, it's more than that. Television channel in the Boston area now, it must be worth $20 million.
We're
sure they
went
bust then.
Is it the FCC or the local government?
Well, it's the FCC.
Yeah, every year, isn't it?
Hmm?
That's up every year.
Yeah, sure. And you know, when you've got a group of five men on the FCC, isn't it? I don't know. Anyway, you've got a small group of men who must somehow go into a trance, and when they're in this trance, decide who is worthy to serve the public with television service, you're going to get corruption. When there are $20 million worth of goodies to be distributed with no clear criteria, there will be bribes paid. One way of paying a bribe is to bribe all sorts of lawyers to go lobby for you. Might be better if we just paid the bribe directly to the U.S. Treasury by having a competitive auction for these services. Well, I don't want to hang up on this anymore. Sure. But the point I want to come back to is that we were concerned yesterday about the possibility that in many industries there just wasn't adequate competition. There might be too much monopoly. That's why I'm talking about the meaning of monopoly. But if firms do not face adequate competition, a sense of social responsibility isn't going to substitute. I've never yet seen a firm that believed that its prices were too high, that its profits were too great. The rationalizations that are available for firms are just infinite in number. If you're doing very well now, you will always maintain that, but someday in the future there will be more competitors and we've got to lay some money aside for a rainy day. How anyone can really believe, and there are people who do believe it, but I don't understand, how anyone can believe that firms will actually look around and say, we are monopolists. We do not have adequate competition. Therefore, we must be socially responsible. How people can believe that's going to occur escapes me. Another thing you got to remember is that when firms do not have adequate competition, like universities, and are allowed, nonetheless, to behave in socially responsible ways. Now, I'm thinking of public universities. Private universities are hustling a little today. They weren't in the 60s, because the bull market was there, and they were getting all the gravy, and they were sort of leaning back and enjoying life, too. But what happens with public universities, which do not face adequate competition, but are allowed nonetheless to go out and be socially responsible, is that they simply inflate their costs. They build empires. They put in circulating pools with nymphs and mermaids they hire extra secretaries and put carpeting on the floors. And but I'd like you to think about the problem, and we'll come back, and you can give me the examples that you've thought of. Where in the American economy today do we find firms with excessive market power? That's what I'm interested in. Firms that have so much control over their market, who face such poor quality substitutes, that they really have us over the barrel in some significant way. Where do you find these firms? Don't answer now. Think about it, and let's toss examples in later. If you do find an example, could we perhaps reduce the market power of these firms by allowing freer foreign trade? Now, that is one way to provide better substitutes for consumers. Automobiles, for example. It seems that one very good way, one very efficient way, a way that involves a minimum of government interference, in fact involves a reduction of some current government interference, would be simply to throw open our borders to the free importation of foreign automobiles. That might make General Motors hustle a little more. What about unions? You think they're... No, not, at least not the unions in the automobile industry. Yeah. That leads to Burke Hartke, which somebody wanted to talk about. Burke Hartke is the current anti-foreign trade bill that's before the Congress. It's a bill that would restrict, well, it's in all sorts, I've never read the bill, but it's a bill that would restrict the right of American corporations to go overseas and produce goods at lower cost and then send them back to the United States, which seems to me to be essentially another restriction on the importation of goods from abroad. It's an anti-import bill, and anti-import bills have always been politically popular in this country because people really do think that somehow you get rich by exporting a lot, which is crazy. You don't. You get rich by importing a lot. But we're sort of job-oriented. What we notice about foreign trade is that when a dingbat comes into the country and I'm a dingbat welder, that dingbat threatens my job. And so we say, keep out foreign dingbats. We even like to quote Abraham Lincoln, who never said it, but well, it's been proved by somebody who ran the history of it down. Abraham Lincoln is supposed to have said, when I buy a dingbat from an American, he started off, I don't know much about economics. That's true, if he said this, but he didn't. He still didn't know much about economics. But anyway, when I buy a dingbat from an American, I have the dingbat and the American has the money. But when I buy a dingbat from an Englishman, I have the dingbat, but the Englishman has the money, which is quite irrelevant. Who wants the money? You say, I do. But why doesn't Englishmen want American money? If Englishmen are willing to take American money, great. We can produce that stuff at zero cost. Let's send it to them. Let's produce money and send it to them. Let them pile it up. What a beautiful world that would be if other countries were willing to sell us things for nothing but American money. Do you realize what the cost is of producing a $20 bill? It's almost zero. The thing is, when we buy a dingbat from an American, I got the dingbat, and he no longer has the dingbat. He's now coal, whatever you use a dingbat for. There's one less dingbat in our forests, but when we buy a dingbat from an Englishman, I have the advantages of that dingbat to consume, and the dingbats are still cavorting gaily through our forests. Well, you can come back. I'm sure you have objections to that, but down with Burke Hartke. What?
The big exploit of Americans.
Well, it's crazy. We really don't want to exploit other countries, but it's absurd. It's one of the continuing absurdities that just frustrate me. The anti-import philosophy. You know, the very phrase, a favorable balance of trade, means an unfavorable balance of trade.
To go along with this thing, you also say that we don't need a gold standard anymore.
We don't have one, so I guess we don't need it.
I mean, in order to ship, produce dollars, you don't want them backed by gold, just produce them, because they're cheap to produce.
Yeah.
As long as it's enough.
As long as what's enough?
Producing the dollars.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's got to be, that's one monopoly I'm in favor of. I do not believe in free competition in the manufacturing of dollar bills. Well, all right, the political power, gee whiz, long-winded, political power of corporations. This is a concern to some of you. I'm going to just raise some questions. When you're worried about the political power of large corporations, are you thinking of them individually or all taken together? But if you think of them as all taken together, should you ever take them all together? Do they ever all get together?
I was the one that raised this. Seth's talking about them individually.
Yeah. Okay.
You mentioned some already before, the special privileges granted. I mean, I think this is political muscle when they can get special privileges granted to them.
Okay, but notice something, that small business has been just as effective as big business, maybe more effective in getting these special privileges. The National Federation of Retail Druggists and the Independent Grocers Alliance and at the state level, your local Association of Independent Undertakers and the Automobile Dealers Association, the Optometrists Association. If you read carefully your local newspaper, if you have a large metropolitan daily, you will find that twice a week at least an instance of some organized lobby of small businessmen, essentially small businessmen, who are together down in the state capitol organizing a raid on your pocketbook. I'm not saying big business doesn't have political power. I'm pointing out that small business has an awful lot of political power too. These small businessmen do get together and they're very effective lobbyists. I think in part because the American political ethic sort of is in favor of the little guy. And when a lot of people look at the ITT case as a horrible example of the political power of large corporations, but you know, you could look at that and say, well, how difficult it is for large corporations to get what they want. They got to pay huge bribes to the Republicans, and then the whole thing may still be reopened, and in any event, wasn't the government's disposition of the ITT case a sensible one? And you can't presuppose that the disposition of that case was wrong, contrary to the public interest. I'm not sure. It's debatable. I guess I do believe on net that ITT should have been allowed to acquire Hartford. But related to this, a lot of people think, a lot of my friends seem to think that large corporations have caused the Vietnam War and still support it. I just don't understand how. Certainly some large corporations have an interest in the continuation of military hostilities. I'll grant that, but you can almost name them. There are just a handful. Most corporations find that the Vietnam War is a pain in the neck. It's a drain on their profits. It causes their taxes to be higher than they otherwise would be. Horror stories exist about there are a lot of horror stories about the political power of large corporations, but horror stories make good reading. How representative are they of the reality? We'll come back to this too. Let me hustle along. And then this other thing, where's Bill now? The widespread belief, I may not be expressing this in the way in which you feel it, but there is among people a widespread belief that we're the pawns of forces beyond our control, often thought of as technological forces beyond our control, and that big business plays an important part in this process of control. It winds up dehumanizing us, making us feel that we have no power over our own lives. I don't know. The first thing I'd say is that technology makes no decisions. I don't like to suppose that technology has any power. It seems to me that only people make decisions. The notion that machines replace people, which is misleading. People replace people with machines because people see net advantages in doing so. And I think looking at it that way, I think that's the right way to look at it, helps you to realize that, well, by golly, there are some possibilities of control. I get nightmares, too, about the machines taking over, marching mindlessly, you know. But I don't think that's the way it's happening.
However, it may be true, and I think it is, that in our urbanized, industrialized, intricately interrelated society, in some areas decisions are so dispersed that we have no effective social control over what emerges from the interaction of individual decision making. That it's kind of, what kind of happens is that nobody wants what happens to happen, but nobody can, by his own decisions, make anything different happen, and so he makes the best of a bad situation, and by doing so contributes to an intensification of the problem.